look at our top stories. Ukraine's President Zelensky says it's time for comprehensive security talks with Moscow as Russia's lead negotiator reports on progress in ceasefire talks. Russia and China raised the alarm over military biological activities in Ukraine labs with support from the U.S., asking for accountability from both countries. And Syria's President Assad visits the United Arab Emirates in his first trip to an Arab state since the war started over a decade ago. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. Ukraine's president calls for meaningful peace and security talks with Russia to end the ongoing conflict in his country.
We were always insisting on the negotiations. We were always offering dialogue, offering a solution for peace, not only during the 23 days of invasion. And I want everyone to hear me now, especially in Moscow. The time has come for a meeting. It is time to talk.
Zelensky says this is Russia's only chance to reduce the harm from its own mistakes. He warned Russia that pushing its campaign means it would need generations to recover from losses suffered during the war. Zelensky added that the time has come to restore the territorial integrity of Ukraine. He also accused Russian forces of blocking the supply of humanitarian aid to Ukrainian cities. Kyiv and Moscow have held several rounds of talks on a ceasefire. Russia's lead negotiator earlier said the talks are making progress on Ukraine's demilitarization. He said, however, that Moscow's demand for co-denazification of Ukraine is yet to be met. Beijing and Moscow are calling on Washington to provide an answer on biological weapons being developed in Ukraine with the U.S. support. Chinese and Russian ambassadors to the U.N. have said Washington and Kyiv should offer clarifications to remove international concerns. They were speaking at the UN Security Council meeting on Friday. China's envoy said the global community should act to ward off, quote, irreparable harm that could be caused. The Russian representative also said there is evidence of dangerous military biological activities in Ukraine. Vasily Nebenzia said the consequences of such activities could go beyond Ukraine's borders and spill over to the entire Europe. He said the U.S. and Ukraine are breaching the Biological Weapons Convention by conducting such activities. Russia has said it has evidence that Ukraine is producing biological arms in laboratories with the U.S. backing. Presidents of China and the United States discussed the war in Ukraine in a virtual meeting with a Chinese leader calling for dialogue to resolve the crisis. Xi Jinping said the U.S. and NATO should recognize the security concerns of Moscow and Kyiv. Xi also criticized the Western sanctions on Russia. He said the measures could trigger serious crises across the globe. She added that the war needs to end as soon as possible. The U.S. president also backed a diplomatic solution in Ukraine. However, he warned China of consequences if it provides material support to Russia's military campaign. Earlier, China and Russia rejected the U.S. claim that they discussed supply of military equipment for Russian forces in the conflict. British Iranians Nazanin Zoghari Ratcliffe and Anousheh Ashoori are back in the UK from Iran after serving a portion of their sentences on espionage charges. The news of their release has been accompanied by rampant speculation about the timing of the repayment of a £400 million decades-old debt to the Islamic Republic. Tehran denies any links between the two events, as Amina Taylor reports from the British capital.
Their return to British soil, like their period of incarceration, a media event of the highest order. British Iranians Nazanin Zoghari Ratcliffe and Anousheh Ashoori touched down at Bryce Norton Air Base in the early hours of Thursday morning. Both had been jailed on espionage charges in Iran. Their release comes after months of delicate negotiations and culminated in their freedom, according to a statement from Iran's foreign ministry, on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. In what has become a media firestorm, much has been made of Britain's repayment of a historic debt to the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic has consistently rejected any links between London's repayment of a decades-old debt and the release of the British Iranian nationals, despite attempts in Western mainstream media reporting to conflate the two issues.
We received the money a few days ago, but simultaneously the judicial process for the release of these two persons was going on. Maybe chronologically, their release and the deposit of the money were close, but there is no connection between these two issues.
UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had previously spoken of making the repayment of Iranian debt a priority.
I've also been very clear that the debt that we owe Iran is legitimate, and we are seeking ways to pay that.
The release of the two dual nationals is the culmination of years of talks between London and Tehran, including a political revelation by then Foreign Secretary, now MP Boris Johnson, that Zaghari Ratcliffe was not a charity worker, as was widely stated.
He admitted, didn't he, at the dispatch box that she was employed by Reuters in training journalists. And as I've said, that is a classic tactic that's used to, you know, develop assets in nations that you know, Britain has hostilities towards. So, you know, in that sense, I think, you know, he let the cat out of the bag. And obviously we know now that, you know, an agreement's been reached and she's been released. But, I mean, I think that did reveal that there was a lot more to this situation than we were being told by the corporate media in this country.
Both Zaghari Ratcliffe and her employer, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, had maintained she was simply visiting family while on vacation. A third person, Murat Abbas, has also been released but remains in Iran for the time being. Amina Taylor, London.
Moving on, the United Arab Emirates says Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visits Persian Gulf country. Right. Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince says the Emirate is keen to strengthen cooperation with Damascus. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed al-Nahyan made the comments in a meeting with Assad. The Syrian president also held talks with Dubai's ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. They emphasized the need for protection of the territorial integrity of Syria and the withdrawal of foreign forces from the country. This was Assad's first visit to an Arab country since the beginning of war in Syria in 2011. Back in 2018, the UAE also reopened its embassy in Damascus and called for Syria's return to the Arab League. Earlier, our correspondent in Syria, Mohammed Ali, gave us the details on the Syrian president's visit to the Emirates.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad visited the United Arab Emirates. He was welcomed there and he met with the Vice President, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. Then Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also met with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who also welcomed the Syrian President there in Abu Dhabi and said that this visit comes in the framework of perhaps joint keenness on continuing consultation and coordination between the two countries on various issues, regional issues and international issues. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad also said that the UAE plays a very important role, taking into consideration the balanced policies that it adopts towards international issues. Also, President Bashar al-Assad pointed out that the world is changing and is heading in the direction of instability, and thus, President Assad went on to say, in order to protect our region, we must continue to adhere to our principles, to the sovereignty of our countries and the interests of our people.
A U.S. military aircraft with four people aboard has crashed in northern Norway. The incident took place during a NATO military exercise. The fate of the passengers of the V-22 Osprey is still unknown. The Norwegian military says the plane was caught in bad weather and hit the ground. Search and rescue teams are looking for the missing passengers. Currently, 3,000 U.S. Marines are taking part in war games in northern Norway. The drills are staged amid rising tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine. Afghanistan is in the grips of an economic crisis after decades of fighting and a U.S.-led occupation. Now the U.N. Security Council has adopted a resolution to secure a formal presence there amid a deepening humanitarian crisis. We discussed the issue earlier in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Well, the UN Security Council adopts a resolution to secure a formal presence in Afghanistan amid a deepening humanitarian crisis there. The Norway-drafted resolution includes several strands of cooperation, namely on humanitarian, political, and human rights fronts. Norway says a motion is crucial to respond to the immediate humanitarian and economic crisis in Afghanistan. It says a resolution will also result in peace and stability there. Afghanistan has experienced decades of fighting and a U.S.-led occupation. It's gripped by an economic crisis after many countries cut off their financial aid, and the U.S. even froze assets following the Taliban takeover last year. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mike Billington from the Asia desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia. And also we have journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tweedy, who's joining us from Plymouth. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Billington. Sir, what do you make of this UNSC resolution, which will effectively secure a more formal presence in Afghanistan, at the situation the situation that the country is experiencing right now?
Well, I don't know if this is going to include recognition of the government in Kabul. If it doesn't, it's just absurd. And saying that they're going to provide humanitarian aid obviously is a decent thing, but this is in the context of the outrageous genocidal policy followed by the U.S. and Europe towards Afghanistan. You said in your opening that the U.S. froze the nine-some billion dollars that belonged to the Afghan Central Bank. The Biden administration went beyond freezing. They stole that money. Some news reports say that they only stole half of it that they intend to use to give to the victims of 9/11, which, of course, the Afghan people had nothing to do with. Even the 9/11 family members have sued Saudi Arabia as the country who actually provided the people responsible for the 9/11 atrocity. But the other half of that money also has not been given to Afghanistan. Biden said he would use that money to help humanitarian aid in Afghanistan, but he took it out of the central bank's account and put it into an American account. That's theft. It's the same kind of theft we saw this last week, where the West decided that they had the power to steal $300 billion belonging to Russia. We've lost any sense of international law. We're now living in a lawless world. We're glad to see somebody is taking concern over the Afghan humanitarian situation, where 1 million children are dying of malnutrition, of starvation, where 24 million people are facing possible death because of the outrageous nature of imposing sanctions on a country that was destroyed over 20 years by NATO, and now they're imposing sanctions and even stealing their money. This is a question of whether the human race has the moral fitness to survive, that they are tolerating that. And the idea that they're screaming and yelling about the poor people in Ukraine, which is, you know, obviously it's a serious problem, people being subjected to warfare. But there are more people dying in Yemen and in Afghanistan every day than are dying in Ukraine. And you don't hear anyone screaming and yelling about that, let alone the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands who were killed in Iraq and Libya and Syria by illegal wars.
Okay, gentlemen, stay with us as we're going to take a look at some online reactions to the news. Well, Faisal Nawabi writes, first of all, the choice of the people is important in Afghanistan. Taliban's recognition and legitimacy depends on Afghans before the international community. Shoaib Pashtin writes, the UN Security Council and Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and others should hear Afghans complaining about the ongoing torture and extrajudicial killings by the Taliban. Most of the people in Afghanistan still think Taliban are the proxies of Pakistan and ask to sanction Pakistan. Here's another user, Jojo, who writes, United Nations recognizing Taliban-led Afghanistan as a bribe to the Taliban so no one can call for punishment of the U.S.'s crimes in Afghanistan. Abolish the UN. It is a Western bullying tool. And lastly, Ruchi Kumar writes, the resolution, which avoids using the word Taliban, will allow the UN to continue its quote-unquote crucial work in Afghanistan. The United Nations has not yet recognized Taliban's pick of envoy to the body, and the resolution does not give the new government international recognition. James Tweedy, let's bring you in on the discussion. Is the direction that the United Nations is taking right now what Afghanistan needs at the moment? And I also saw you nodding your head there when Mr. Billington was speaking. If you'd also like to add anything to his comments, go ahead, please.
Thanks for having me here. The general problem with aid or humanitarian assistance or charity or whatever you want to call it, is that the aid giver is substituting themselves for the government, the authorities in the country where they're giving it out. You know, often they're substituting themselves for the health ministry or the education system or something like that. And the other one is that it makes the recipient of the aid dependent on the aid giver. So this is not, you know, this is not allowing for, you know, the country in question to become sovereign and independent and to stand up for itself. So obviously, yes, that, you know, that money that the US has sequestered from Afghanistan needs to be returned, and it needs to be returned to the government. And that might be politically problematic for the US and for the UN in general, because the state of Afghanistan that existed until last summer does not exist anymore, and now it is the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is the official word, the official name of the Taliban. This is the government, and if you want to be doing anything in Afghanistan, that's who you've got to deal with more.
Okay, jump in there, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Mike Billington from Leesburg, James Sweetie from Plymouth, thank you for contributing to this segment of the program. And that's it with this edition of the News Review.
Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thanks for your company.
New Year, Nowruz is almost here.
Join IRIB English Radio on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
We celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022, around the traditional half-seen table.
We wish you a wonderful and prosperous Nowruz.
Domestic violence is abuse that happens in a personal relationship. Domestic violence affects men and women of any ethnic group, race or religion, rich or poor, teen, adult or elderly. But most of its victims are women. In fact, one out of four women will be a victim at some point. The abuser may use fear, bullying, and threats to gain power and control over the other person. These signs of abuse may happen soon after the start of the relationship and might be hard to notice at first. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Affluent, educated, safe. This is Singapore's public face. But this seemingly ideal country, famously known as the Little Red Dot, has her dark secrets. The unemployment rate stands at less than 5%, and the crime rate is one of the lowest in the world. But other numbers tell a different side of her story. 1 in 10 women in Singapore has experienced physical violence or sexual abuse, and 6 in 10 have endured violence repeatedly. But only a fraction of these victims come forward to the authorities for help. This week on Aperture, we will take a walk into the world of abused spouses in Singapore and follow the journey of three abused women to learn of their trauma, hear of their heartbreak, and share their dreams. Stay with us.
When an educated society hears but does not listen,
he would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public.
When victims are shamed into silence.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that.
When home is no longer a safe haven, where do these women find the courage to be no longer victims? Singapore, a small island nation with big dreams. Where 1 in 4 have a university degree. 90% own a home. The unemployment rate stands at an underwhelming 2%. And over 100,000 millionaires call this home. But behind the numbers, there are secrets best kept hidden.
I thought he would be a good husband. During courtship days, he really took very good care of me. He really doted on me, was very affectionate, very loving. I would say that he went out of his way to accommodate my requests, you know. So there was really no warning signs, you know, that he would change so drastically after marriage.
At 20, Rachel found out she was pregnant.
I think it's more of society's pressure than, you know, because 16 years ago, it's not very acceptable, you know, to be a single mother. And also I wanted a complete family for my kid. So it was more of an obligation.
Just months into the marriage, the verbal abuse started.
From someone who's very loving to you, you know, who treated you like a queen, you know, put you on a pedestal, and then, you know, suddenly that someone actually tells you, know, that you are the reason why he lost his job, you know, because of certain superstition or, you know, your birthday clash, you know, that kind of thing, and you know, it's all your fault. And then how can you put on so much weight after pregnancy? I didn't sign up for that, you know, and I can't even bear to look at you now.
This was the start of Rachel's 8-year ordeal of living with an abusive husband. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child.
We were having an argument. I was defending my point of view. And then he just snapped and he just shoved me.
Abandoned, shocked, betrayed. Rachel struggled with all these emotions.
I think most importantly is that I really didn't want to accept the fact that, you know, he was like that, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be moving on. And given the fact that, you know, we are already married and we have a child on the way, you know, I felt very trapped.
Money and the lack of close family support also reduced her options.
Emotionally, it was because my parents didn't like him. So it was a case of, like, you know, I told you so. Back then, the laws didn't allow divorcees to buy their own house, so housing would be an issue. Also, in terms of financially, I wonder if I would be able to support the child on my own.
Rachel hoped the baby would change him, make him softer, happier. But the stresses of first-time parenthood quickly dispelled her illusions.
Things got actually worse when the baby kept crying. You know, he would scream at me and ask me, you know, oh, what kind of mother are you? You don't even know how to take care of your own kid. I don't see other people's babies screaming or crying like that, you know.
His anger reached a boiling point after he lost his job and the family became reliant on Rachel's income.
He perceived it as some kind of attack on his manlyhood. And given the fact that I gradually earned more than him over the years, it didn't bode well for our relationship.
A few drinks, a perceived disobedience, and the cycle would start again.
He was hitting me. He was raining blows on me, and I fell over the wrong way. Yeah, I actually hit my back actually hit against the side of the coffee table. Yeah, and I just fell over. Yeah, so my back was thrown at a very unnatural angle.
Hours flowed into days, weeks into months, months into years. But all roads still led headfirst into a brick wall.
I really lost count. I've been in A&E for my slip disc. I thrown up my back, various kind of bleeding, head injuries. I had to go for CT scan, MRIs.
All this time, Rachel chose to hide her pain and lead a double life.
Sometimes I feel like such a fraud, you know. Obviously, at home, I'm going through all these things, you know, and I already feel very injured. Injured not only physically, you know, emotionally. I feel very betrayed, you know. Feel very angry. And you have to hide all that, you know, because during work, you know, I had to be very professional, okay? And I don't want to bring my personal life into my professional life, you know, and to maintain that kind of professional respect, you know, the kind of facade that I have to put up.
On average in Singapore, 3,000 spousal abuse cases are reported each year. But family violence specialists believe this represents just the tip of the iceberg.
We also know that less than 10% of women who have experienced abuse come forward to the formal helping agencies, whether it's the police or whether it's the family service centre. So what prevents these people from getting help?
One key reason why Rachel stayed with her husband for as long as she did was for her children, who never saw their father beating their mother.
While he wasn't a good husband, he was a good father. So I was very conflicted. While I had to take care of myself, I also have to consider the feelings of my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to have a broken family. I really tried to make things work. There was a lot of self-doubt. Am I too strong? Should I be more docile? Should I be more submissive? Should I be more gentle?
All her doubts were finally erased one night.
I was sleeping, you know, he just pulled me out of bed and, you know, he was hitting me. And my elder daughter actually came out of her room. She was very, very shocked when she saw what was going on. She was very brave. She tried to protect me, so she was trying to pull him off me. At that point, I think he was very infuriated, you know. So he didn't realize it was her, so he just flung her off. She was thrown against the wall. That was really the last straw for me, that she was being physically thrown off like that. It just made me snap in a way that I realized that, you know, it had to stop right there and then.
The very next day, Rachel and her two daughters moved out. Her husband immediately tried to apply for a personal protection order against her, saying that she had injured him during the fight.
The officer who processed the case, when he called me up to investigate the matter, you know, I actually showed him the reports, the medical reports, you know, and the different police reports I made over the years, you know, and I showed it to him. I mean, just look, and what do you think? So that case was actually thrown out.
She filed for divorce the very same week, but it took 2 years before the case was settled. Rachel gave up on alimony in exchange for full custody of their children.
I've always told them that whatever happened between me and their father, it's between the adults. And it's very difficult for me to say this, but I always told them, you know, that they shouldn't hate him. They are entitled to feel anger, of course, and to work on that anger, you know. But I don't want them to hate him.
The International Violence Against Women survey that we completed in 2010 was done because we felt that up to that point, as a country, as a nation, we had no idea as to the prevalence of violence against women nationwide. And we found that 9.2%, or 1 out of 10 women that we surveyed, reported they experienced physical violence and or sexual abuse from their partners.
The survey used a sample size of 2,000 women aged 18 to 60 years old and asked very specific questions. Have you been slapped, punched, and strangled? Has sex been forced upon you against your will? And out of those 1 in 10 women who answered yes, another number came to light.
More than half of them said it has happened more than once. 3 times, 6 times, you know. So we're not talking about people who, on the first instance of violence, you know, begin to go to the police or shout for help and all that.
When is domestic violence a public issue? Who has a right to intervene? Why do victims remain silent?
It's not a slap or two. I was really getting beaten up badly in public, in the house, and I still kept quiet and smiled.
Power. Control. Dominance. These are the driving forces behind domestic violence. Shame, fear, isolation. These are the shackles holding victims in place. Family, children, a happy ever after. This is what Mira hoped for when she married her first love.
We had really good chemistry. I mean, he spoke very, very well. He made me laugh.
In the first year of marriage, when Mira was 7 months pregnant, the violence kicked in.
He used vulgarities on me, calling me a and I answered him back. And that's when he kicked my head like it was a football and stepped on my head. I screamed for help. I tried to open the door as I got up, screaming for my mother-in-law to help. He pulled my hair back, continued to beat me up even more. And after that, he told me why he beat me up, made it my fault, and I had to go down and apologize to my mother-in-law and say it's my fault.
The day Mira's son was born, she saw a flicker of hope.
The day I gave birth, he was awesome. That's when I felt that amazing man I married. He was there throughout the time I was in labor and all. After that, things changed completely because that night itself, drank him back. Being in the hospital, basically I was abused terribly as I was practically bedridden in bed, vulgarities, everything. So it became a weekly affair, you could say, of getting abused physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mira's husband had a temper and he wasn't shy about showing it wherever and whenever his buttons were pushed.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public. Imagine, he beat me up among the clubs in Serangoon Road, dragged me on the road and all. And when someone tried to come and help me and he told the guy, this is my wife, you don't touch her, you don't have any right to touch her. Nobody helped me. Everyone just watched the fun.
When Mira's husband lost his temper, it wasn't just a slap or a shove.
He's a very strong guy. He never beat me like it was a woman giving a slap. He beat me up like a guy. 2 fractures, a bleeding nose, multiple bruises to the head, multiple bruises to the thighs, to the back, an extremely swollen rib for a good 2 weeks. Name it. Been there, done that. And yeah, the last one, permanent scar for life, a slash on the face.
Beyond the physical abuse, what cut us deeply were the relentless emotional attacks that shattered her self-esteem.
Emotionally, what he would do is this. He abused me in front of his mom, his maid, his friends. He called me a prostitute. He says I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy wife. I should be grateful that he married me, that, you know, I'm living with his family and all that, and food is there and all. I should feel grateful.
We've come across many cases where you have both emotional violence as well as physical violence. And what is really striking is that when a victim relates what she remembers of the incidents, it's very often it's the emotional violence, it's the words used that, you know, actually has the deepest scars.
Mira believes her family would have intervened strongly had they known what was going on, but she chose to hide the abuse from them.
I didn't want to involve my family because I didn't want my family to look down on him. I wanted my marriage to work. Nobody gets married thinking, okay, fine, I get married today and when am I going to divorce? Nobody does that. Marriage is sacred. A man and woman gets married, they have children, they go to work, they bring up their kids, and you know, they see their kids through teen years and all that. That's life. And that's what I wanted. Why I stuck through is not just simply because of marriage. I really loved him.
Although her family did not know about the abuse initially, her husband's family did. But they chose to turn a blind eye.
My mother-in-law saw me get abused. She watched me get abused. He's got 3 other siblings. I did seek help, crying to his sisters, younger one and older one. Younger one was very much more empathetic towards me. But they felt that they couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond control. I was always told that it's, you know, it's in my hands to change him.
By the end of their first year of marriage, Mira had obtained a personal protection order, or PPO. If her husband is violent against her, he can be fined up to $2,000, jailed up to 6 months, or both. But the PPO does have its limitations. It's not a restraining order which would prevent the abusive spouse from coming near or having contact with the victim.
The perpetrator could follow the victim to work, could call the victim all the time, send her SMSs, you know, multiple SMSs to harass her, could sort of always be within sight of the victim but not actually physically touch her. So all of these things can be intimidating, very, very annoying, disruptive to the victim's life still. And in other countries, the court has the power to actually restrict and to prohibit the perpetrator from carrying out these acts. I think those kinds, the court should actually have wider powers to make such orders in Singapore as well.
Despite the PPO, the threats continued. 10 months later, Mira moved back to her parents' house for the third time. Her husband turned up at the company where she worked.
He came to my office and humiliated me. He was drunk in the morning, calling me the CBD in front of everyone, lunchtime.
A few days later, he broke into her mother's apartment at 6 in the morning.
He broke into my home with a knife and a brick. I had my siblings, my brother, my son and all there. He pinned me down as I had my son in my arms. He slashed me behind my ear, on my face. I was screaming. Everyone was awake in my home. It was chaos. My sister-in-law, my sister and all helped me. They took my son away. I ran out of the home. I thought he was going to come after me with a knife, but he didn't. All he did was say that he just wanted to disfigure me and leave.
Mira's husband was arrested and sentenced to more than 6 months in prison. He has just been released.
If he's going to try and come back, I would just do the simple thing. I'll call the police. I mean, I have a PPO. So I will call the police and all, and he knows that if he's going to try and come back, it's going to be even a tougher sentence this time. During my marriage, I was really afraid and I lived in fear. So at this point of time, I'm very confident. I don't need to feel afraid anymore.
Waiting, watching, standing still. More often than not, this is the norm, not the exception.
So I think Singaporeans make very good bystanders. I think that's something that is part of our conditioning. We are a society where we are peace-loving, law-abiding, and we generally let the authority take care of a problem. I think that this is a function of, one, Singapore being a fast-paced urban country where there people may not have as much time for each other. There may not be that much trust between strangers. And there is a certain attitude that we should each mind our own business.
How does the law define spousal violence? What happens to cases which don't meet the legal criteria? How do we help the most vulnerable victims?
Yes, we don't have any
5.2 million people live in Singapore today. Over 2 million of them are foreigners. Drawn here by dreams of wealth, the promise of work, and the hope of love. In recent years, approximately 40% of marriages in Singapore have been between a citizen and a foreigner.
One in three of the women that are presented with issues of spousal violence are actually foreign wives. And this was actually an increase from the previous years, where it was one in five of every woman that came forward to seek help.
Love, convenience, citizenship. There are many reasons why foreign women marry Singaporean men. But one common theme recurs in these relationships.
So generally what we hear from our foreign wives is that there's a sense of fear that they're often threatened by their husbands. At the end of the day, if they are going to report, for example, about the spousal violence incidents, they're going to be sent back to their home countries. And then they risk not able to see their children or maybe even lose custody of their children because of their citizenship or legal right to be in Singapore.
This has been Vu's story since she came to Singapore.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In this episode, we are going to discuss with you ways to reach our goal. And this is an important point. How to reach our goal is a question that always remains and it props up in our mind. It comes to our mind usually as to how we should reach our goal. We know, obviously, that man has been created for a goal and he has a purpose to achieve in his life. And it is very much important that every individual knows what he has been created for and what are the goals that he has to achieve. After he understands his ultimate goal, it is then necessary for him to try to achieve it and to try to find ways to achieve that goal. Before anything else, of course, we should pay attention to 2 points. First, we should observe our goal constantly during our lives. Day in and day night, we should try to seek our goals after we have understood what our goal is. Otherwise, if we do not keep in mind what our goal is, if we do not try to achieve it, we cannot, utilize our power for our aim. And the ordinary affairs will actually, capture our attention. We will be overwhelmed by ordinary and day-to-day lives and activities. It's also very common for human beings who are not successful in their program to try to get rid of their difficulties through actually a denial of the program that they are following. It's very much common that even they forget their goals once they are overwhelmed by the daily activities and by day-to-day activities. We should pray and ask Allah seriously to help us, to save us, and we cannot, continue this spiritual journey, and we cannot achieve our sacred goals, our ultimate goals, without His help, without Allah's help. When we talk about goals, we are not talking about ordinary goals. For example, to build a house is just an ordinary goal that aims to bring us ease and comfort in this life. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We are talking about the ultimate goal, the most important goal that we should follow, that we have. And of course, if you are serious about achieving our ultimate goal, we need God's help. And of course, with His help, with Allah's help, there will be no obstacle and nothing can stop us. So in the relationship with Allah, we should not feel self-sufficient because we are completely and absolutely dependent on Allah. We are God's creature and we are squarely dependent on Allah's help. Of course, our relationship with Allah is different from our relationship with others. In the relationship with others, we should trust ourselves and rely on our own powers without allowing despair to capture our hearts. We cannot rely on others when it comes to our relationship with other people. The Prophet, peace be upon him, was the bravest man and stood against all enemies and was able to change the world. The Prophet said, "Oh my God, do not ever leave me by myself even for an instant." So there's no doubt that we are dependent on Allah in our life, in our breathing, in our success, in our every activities. You know, if God leaves us to ourselves or by ourselves for even 1 second or less than a second, we will perish. We will cease to exist in this world. So that's why it's very important to understand that we are dependent on Allah's help. Whether we want it or not, we are squarely dependent on Allah. Let's listen to Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam when he asks Allah for help. What does he say? He says, "Glory be to Allah. How narrow are the paths for him whom you have not guided. How plain the truth for him whom you has guided on his way. My God, so make us travel on the roads that arrive at you, and set us into motion on the paths nearest to reaching you." So this is the dua and this is the plea of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam. Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam further says, "Make near for us the far, make easy for us the hard and difficult. Join us to your servants, those who hurry to you swiftly, knock constantly at your door and worship you by night and day while they remain apprehensive in awe of you." So the dua of the supplication of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam is lengthy. Obviously, if you are interested, you can in fact continue and go on. You can read his Sahifa Sajjadiyya, which includes his supplications and prayers. Dear brothers and sisters, to put everything in a nutshell, I would say that we have been created for a purpose and we must achieve that purpose with the help of Allah, not with the help of our neighbors, not with the help of our human fellows, and only on God we should trust. In God we should trust, and it's only through Allah, with the help of Allah, that we can achieve perfection, we can achieve a better life, and we can achieve happiness in our life.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Allah Almighty has sent us prophets, and the last of the prophets is Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who brought for us the Holy Quran, which is the most important source of guidance for us, and we need to benefit from the teachings of the Quran. Quran is not only for reading, it's not only for keeping it in our house for blessing. We need to benefit from the Quran. We need to understand it. We need to act on the teachings of the Quran in order to achieve our ultimate goal. And of course, as just as I said, the goals are different. Some of them are temporary and transient, and those are the goals that we need to achieve in this world. But there is an ultimate goal, and that ultimate goal is the goal for which we have been created. We have been created to worship Allah. We have been created to achieve proximity to Allah. And we have been created to prove our servitude to Allah. So servitude is the goal for which we have been created. And of course, we cannot worship Allah, we cannot serve God without purifying ourselves, without self-purification, without ridding ourselves of impurities, of filth. And just as a tree needs to be pruned to achieve and to perfection, to grow, we also need to remove the impurity from ourselves in order to achieve a better life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every
sheet of palm, every closed hand in us, every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us, every thought I have and every word I share in us, alone knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.